My name is Matt Provost. I'm based out of London. I work for a company called Avira Systems. Before that, I worked for 6 years in Wellington, New Zealand at Weta Digital, which is Sir Peter Jackson's visual effects facility. So during that time, I did interesting things, like I ran 7 computers in the top 500 supercomputer list, making Avatar. It kind of got bigger from there to do things like Hobbit. So what I'm going to talk today about is infrastructure outage planning. So this is something that I've had to do a lot of times in my career, right? You need to upgrade the system for performance or capacity or to fix a bug or something. There's already been a few interesting talks yesterday about this kind of topic. Charity did a really good one yesterday. So how do you do these things when you're really talking at infrastructure scale, which is what I think, when we're talking to an audience of SREs, what you're talking about is building the infrastructure of the internet, right? We're not just building websites anymore. We're building sort of, to the point that it's getting to be critical infrastructure. Now, it may be infrastructure for, delivering pictures of cats, but, no judging. And I like to do this by looking at examples from other industries. So we're going to have a look at a particular incident that happened this Christmas. So this is King's Cross Station in London. It's one of the biggest train stations in the UK. It's the southern terminus of the East Coast Main Line, which is the long-distance, high-speed rail line to Yorkshire, the northeast, and Scotland. So every year, 47 million passengers go through this station. That's about two-thirds as many as Heathrow Airport. And they have to do critical maintenance on the rail lines, every once in a while. And for some reason, they like to do this over the holidays. So this is Google Earth view of the area. Sort of showing the layout. So this is King's Cross here. That's the neighboring station, St. Pancras, where you get trains that go through the tunnel to Paris. And basically, there are 4 lines coming out of it, going up through the north. And they were going to replace 500 meters of track on 2 of those lines. That was going to require removing 6,000 tons of the rock ballast that goes underneath the train lines as well, and sort of putting in new rock and tamping it down and everything else. You can see in the upper right-hand corner, there's a stadium that's Emirates Stadium, the home of Arsenal. So usually when something goes wrong, the rail works were in the section right before the stadium. And usually when something goes wrong in this part of town, everybody blames this guy. That reminds me of one of my favorite episodes of the IT Crowd. So did you see that ludicrous display last night? What was Wenger thinking sending Walcott on that early? The thing about Arsenal is they always try to walk it in. That's the end of my football knowledge. I'm a big fan of Sidney Decker and his books like Drift into Failure. I really recommend anybody that's interested in this kind of topic read this. I was talking with John Allspaugh last night about what disciples of the Church of Decker should call ourselves. I think we agreed on Deckerians. And once you start understanding the way he puts things forward, you really see things kind of through that viewpoint of how to do these sort of postmortem analyses. And one of the things you see in every postmortem is a declaration of basically, we weren't idiots. We didn't think we were going to, things were going to go wrong. And one of the opening statements of the report that came out of this was that the project had been assessed with an industry standard risk assessment tool and had received a score of 95% certainty that they would finish on time. So they always establish that sort of groundwork. But he has a concept that he calls decrementalism, which is basically that in a complex system, doing the same thing twice doesn't predictably or necessarily lead to the same results. So past success can't be taken as a guarantee of future success or safety. So really what we're going to see is, was this some sort of black swan event, low probability, high effect, that they really couldn't predict it, and the 95% figure was accurate. So in the end, They were gonna do this outage over Christmas Day and Boxing Day, which were Thursday and Friday, take down all four lines, and then on Saturday morning hand back two of the lines and continue working over the weekend, and on Monday morning hand back all four lines. They ended up overrunning by 50%, so they didn't hand back the lines until Sunday morning, which meant that the Saturday was basically complete chaos. It's also a really quiet time of year for news, so the media really latched onto this, and pictures of people standing outside the station in the cold makes for great media. So shortly after the event in January, Network Rail, which is the company responsible for running Britain's rail network, commissioned a study, basically a post-mortem, into finding out what went wrong. There's also an official government report, and those were the sort of basis of the detail that I got for this talk. In the end, 36,000 tickets had been booked for the Saturday, so all of those were canceled. They estimate that 115,000 passengers were affected by the outage. And this is a great one, and I think it's something people can use in their outages, but it caused 8,659 delay minutes. So that's the number of trains times the number of delays, all that kind of thing. So we're gonna go through the findings. They had sort of four causes that they identified and then some conclusions. So the outage started on Christmas Eve, actually, between 10 and 11 o'clock at night. And they started with phase one, which they called scrapping out, where they cut up the rail lines, took them off, dug out the sleepers, which are the things that the rails sit on, and loaded those all up onto trains and took them away. So in order to do this, they had gone out and they'd bought eight brand new, what they call log grabs. So these are big hydraulic grippers that they use to pull these things up. They bought eight brand new ones, and they did this so that they wouldn't have any trouble with unreliable equipment. So they had seven and a spare. The problem was that the hydraulic fittings didn't match the rest of the equipment that they were using. So as soon as they started using it, they started losing hydraulic pressure, hydraulic fluid was going everywhere. They had a few repair people on site running around trying to sort of get things going. But it was kind of a little bit of a disaster from the start. So they finally finished doing this at 9 o'clock Christmas morning. And then they really got to this point that I call the sort of the squirrel point, right? So if you've ever seen a squirrel crossing the road, and maybe you're trying to avoid running it over in your car, you know that they can change their mind at any point. They can get 99% of the way across the road and then decide, actually, the nuts where I was look a lot better. So they sort of do this back and forth. And there are these points during every outage, right? You have these checkpoints where you say, okay, what's our progress looking like? Do we have enough time to finish? So by 9 a.m., they were 4 hours behind, and only after starting at 11 o'clock at night. So they were behind schedule. They'd allocated 45 minutes into the schedule for overrun at this point. So they really consider themselves to be 3 hours and 15 minutes behind. The official government report stressed that as part of its planning, National Rail should make sure there are clear no-go decision points for the works. So they did have a decision-making process. They decided ahead of time that if there were less than 4 hours delayed, then they could continue with the works. They decided that their four-hour delay minus the 45 minutes qualified them for that. And they also had a choice at this point, and this was really the critical point, because now they had to start digging out the rock. And they had two options there. They could dig out the full 6,000 tons, go 300 millimeters deep, and complete the work, which ultimately would give them a track that would last for 25 years. Or they could skim off the top of the rock, put on a quick layer, and put on the new tracks, but that might only last for 10 years. And of course, digging out the full thing was gonna take more time. The other sort of critical factor here was that once they decided to go one way or the other, they couldn't really change their minds. Because once they decided to start digging deep, they couldn't later decide to do part of it at another one. Apparently, that makes the foundation unstable. So one of the things is, at this point, do you sort of reassess and say, I'm still 95% confident that we're gonna meet our schedule? Probably not. But for better or worse, they decided to go ahead and do the full depth dig. And this was really the turning point of the whole thing. Essentially, this you can't really point at necessarily one decision that changes the whole thing, but this was the key moment. So pretty quickly, they ran into something that they hadn't planned on because of the delays that they had overnight. So shortly after 9 o'clock, the go point, two drivers on the scrap trains that were pulling the cut-up rails and sleepers hit their shift limits. So train drivers, train engineers, have strict legal limits for safety reasons on how long they can be on a shift, right? So this, you know, sort of goes into that, but 10-hour shifts during a 24-hour period, 8 overnight. In exceptional circumstances, you can go to 12. Once you come off shift, you can't go back on for 6 hours. So because of that 4-hour delay in the morning, all of a sudden some of the train engineers working overnight hit their shift limits and were done for the day. So what they did was they had other trains further down the track. They had taken over 9 miles of track, and they had 14 trains spread over that. So they took some of the other drivers, pulled them forward to drive some of those trains off. They call this cascading, and that's how they're going to get it done. But this was really a sort of critical factor that they hadn't really planned. And I just have to say, from personal experience, it's not the first outage that's gone wrong due to driver issues. So by 2 o'clock on Christmas Day, they were 6 hours behind. So they've been optimistic. You get to this point and you say, well, we built these contingency times into our plan. So, you know, in the morning they said, well, we built a plan in that we can be up to 4 hours behind at this point. We're 4 hours behind, that's okay. Effectively what you're saying is, we think everything that could have gone wrong has already gone wrong, and everything from here on out is going to be fine. And then that's kind of what happens when you build slack into your schedule, right? But by 2 o'clock in the afternoon, they were now 6 hours behind, so they weren't catching up. Things were getting worse. And shortly after midnight on Christmas, the supply of new drivers ran out. So there were 300 rail projects going on across the UK over Christmas. So effectively, every train driver in the country was on duty. And they ran out. So they had all hit their shift limits. At this point, they had one driver and 5 trains left on site. So he would drive one, get on a truck, somebody would take him back, he'd get on the next one, drive it back out, and he was sort of quickly coming up on his limit. Now, once you get past that in the next day, because people, you know, some of the other drivers can go home and have a sleep and come back on shift the next day, but effectively this really is what slowed them down. So when you're doing an IT outage, this is the point, sometimes where you just say, well, that's it. We're not going to hit the schedule. By 11 o'clock in the morning on Boxing Day, they were 15 hours behind schedule. But their contingency plan didn't have any arrangements for handing the station over more than 1 hour behind schedule. They'd been 95% confident that they were going to do it. And apparently that 5%, they put so much slack into the schedule that it never, they never sort of planned for anything other than maybe the first few trains might be delayed and people queue up for a little while. In terms of rolling back, at this point they'd already cut up the tracks and started digging up the rock, so there really is no rollback. And I think, even in IT, you always do get to these points, right, where you commit yourself. So I think, again, Charity was talking yesterday about, you're doing a database upgrade and you start the upgrade and it's going to go through the database and change the on-disk layout. And halfway through that, you can't just Control-C, right, and just say, well, we're done. But you always can, you know, you do have options like, you know, restoring for backup. So when, you know, you're doing these this planning, you always have to say, how long is it going to take me to put the system back the way it was, even if I have to get it from tape? And that's that sort of point of no return. Now, the other thing that that was a real factor here in infrastructure thinking, and I think this is relevant for a lot of people, is when do you start thinking about yourself as running infrastructure, right? If you're at a startup, are you really solving long-term problems? Now, for some of the people working on this, they're going to put down new track that's going to last 25 years. If you're my age, then you're done, right? Like, you're never going to have to think about this problem again. You're going to be retired by the time somebody else has to do this. So there's a lot of temptation to sort of do things for a long time. If you're at a startup, you know, you can't really afford to think long term. You know, I'm going to build a network that's going to last for 5 years, and your board of directors is trying to, you know, sell the company to Facebook within the next 6 months. So all that sort of hard work is going to be completely wasted. And a lot of teams, you know, that I've been on, sort of over time, especially an established team, goes through this phase where they switch to infrastructure thinking. You know, I've been working at this company for 5 years. I'm going to be working at this company forever. So, you know, I'm just going to solve problems once. I think this is kind of, you know, something that engineers can get stuck in. I'm going to pick on somebody here that, you know, thinks they can solve problems once and never have to look at it again. Anyway, this is just one example of a project that tried that. I'm sure most people probably get the reference. But there's many, many more where that came from, right? I'll solve this once in my career and never have to think about it again. So this is another one of their findings that I think is relevant. So it was Boxing Day, the rails are shut down anyway. So when things started to go wrong, most of the staff was on vacation, right? Was on holiday. And so this is always a problem when you do infrastructure outages. Let's say in the middle of the night, you have, you know, in a traditional company before the whole, you know, DevOps thing, you know, you have sort of separated teams, you know, network admins, system admins, DBAs, programmers, project managers. And in most companies, most of those people wouldn't be there, right? It would be the system admin team or the DBA team or whoever was sort of doing the outage. And then you run into some problem and you say, you know, I don't really know what's going on. Who wrote this code? And they're asleep, right? They're not in. And this is one of the things they ran into was once they decided that they were going to overrun their deadline, they were going to have to do things like redo the train schedules. Well, the people that write the train schedules weren't at work. One of the worst things was the people manning their social media accounts, like their Twitter accounts, also weren't at work. So everybody started griping on Twitter, and they weren't able to sort of get any public responses. In fact, the chief executive of Network Rail, Mark Carn, was on Christmas vacation in Cornwall with his family. He only got told at 2 p.m. On Boxing Day. Ultimately, it cost him, he was due for a £135,000 performance bonus, which he had to forfeit because of this. So that probably ruined his Christmas a little bit. So they put into effect what they call Emergency Plan Alpha 1. Now, this is the plan for a total closure of King's Cross. And it's really designed for essentially a train crash or terrorism or something like that. You know, there's a bomb threat, the station's shut. They put this plan into effect. What it does is they go to the next train station down the line, Finsbury Park, which is near the Arsenal station. But it wasn't really designed for this sort of operational contingency. It was designed for actual emergencies, so it didn't really have you know, a lot of planning put into what to do. Is just shut the station down, get all the trains somewhere, we'll deal with the aftermath later. So Finsbury Park, the next station down the line, is not nearly as big as King's Cross. It doesn't have any lifts or escalators. There's no level access to the trains there. So it just can't handle those passenger numbers. Now, it is near the stadium, so it is used to having, you know, large amounts of people go in and out, but that's what they call like a tidal flow. So right before the game, everyone's coming off the trains towards the stadium. After the game, everyone's coming out of the stadium onto the trains. So where they really ran into trouble was that in this case, they had trains coming in and people trying to get on and off the same train. So at a certain point, there were so many people on the platforms that the British Transport Police were afraid of people falling under the trains and they shut the station. Which was really, you know, it's the safe thing to do, right? There were thousands of people standing on train platforms that are quite narrow. So this is what the inside of the station looked like. Just completely packed. And of course, people are on Twitter, you know, posting about this kind of stuff. This is what the outside of the station looked like. Thousands of people standing, you know, it's Christmas, it was cold, it was raining. Thousands of people standing in the rain, you know, waiting to get their trains. But at infrastructure scale, it's prohibitively expensive to have fully redundant systems, right? So you can do that at a small scale. You know, people were talking yesterday about storage systems, and you have, you know, a redundant storage system. You've got head A and head B, and you can fail over. There aren't any empty train stations, right? Nobody builds a second airport next to Heathrow in case there's a problem with air traffic control at Heathrow and they have to shut it down. It's just too expensive. And even at scale, right, you know, you look at companies like Google and Facebook and everything, they do these big distributed things and they can survive the failure of a data center, you know, and that's great. They can't survive, you know, well, unless somebody knows something I don't, they can't survive a failure of half of their data centers or three quarters of their data centers. They don't just have that much slack capacity built into the system. And so this, you know, this is one of the things. You know, so if usually when you pick a time to do an outage, you look at that sort of big graph you have of your network traffic, and you pick a low point. So you say, I'm going to do it on a Sunday night or a Monday morning, or you know, whenever the low point is, you know, for that. The problem is as you're running against the clock and you're overrunning, now the graph is starting to tick back up, and so at midnight, during your lowest point, you may have had plenty of extra capacity to shut one system down and fail everything over to its backup and kind of have an outage without much public effect. But as things start going further and further, as they're heading towards Monday morning when people are going to start commuting to work again, you know, things are sort of looking much worse. So in the end, they did end up essentially losing a day on Saturday, having to, you know, just cancel a lot of people's Christmas plans. You know, so this was not great for families, and they handed over two lines on Sunday, and then had everything back up and running Monday morning for the commuters. So the conclusions of the report are interesting. I mean, I think some of the language. So this is talking about they're going to put passenger disruption at the very heart of their planning. It clearly wasn't, right? So the people working on this project got into a mode where the work they were doing was the most important thing, right? They wanted to fix the problem at hand. And this is something that engineers do, right? So I'm going to fix this. I'm going to fix this the best way possible. I'm going to dig it out and make a 25-year solution so I don't have to think about this again. That's the best way to do it. And effectively, you know, some people probably knew that they were going to overrun and affect people's Christmas plans, but that was a sort of secondary factor. What they're saying now, and it remains to be seen, is whether you actually put that as a primary factor. And you sort of get into these, you know, someone I was talking to the other day compared this to like a sunk cost kind of thing, you know, and that's that squirrel point of like, I'm 90% across the road, I've done all this work. You know, it would have been a really tough call after they'd cut up all the rail lines and all that stuff for someone just to say, listen, you know, we're too late already. We lost too much time. Let's just put some new rail lines back and try again next year. And having made no forward progress, that's the rollback, right? That's a difficult call to make for an engineer. And that's why really there needs to be some communication with the sort of business side of things or project management or someone that's a little bit less kind of emotionally invested in the work that you're doing, that doesn't necessarily just need to see the work go ahead, but look at the bigger picture. Like, what are we trying to accomplish here? And in this case, it's like we're trying to accomplish being a rail system, which involves getting people on trains and getting them where they're going. And maybe we just have to take a delay and do some hard lessons. And there was a lot of money at stake, right? This work cost £4 million and involved 8,000 hours of work. So it's a big deal to sort of say, you know, halfway through that, whoops, we messed up. But ultimately, it's about understanding where your priorities are. The other one, I think everyone will agree with. This is pretty common. You know, your dev or your test environment should always get your newest equipment first, right? If you're going to, you know, buy something new or try some new software or something like that. But you know, this often gets left behind when you're doing sort of in the moment, especially capacity or performance upgrades, right? So your site is there, you need more network bandwidth. You know, you're struggling under the load. What do? You go out, you buy a new switch, you put it in, you find out that there's a bug in that version or on that motherboard or something else, but you don't necessarily have the time in every case to put stuff into a complete environment and do load testing and all that stuff. So sometimes people take shortcuts. They thought they were doing the right thing by buying new equipment. You know, new stuff is more reliable than old stuff. The other thing they did, and this is one of my sort of pet subjects, but is they went out and they bought everything, you know, the same exact thing. They bought 8 of these things. I'm a big fan of sort of spreading your risk by splitting things out. You know, buy something from vendor A, buy a model from vendor B. You know, the worst that happens is you find out the hydraulic fittings on one model don't work, you've still got four that are fine. But it's always easier to standardize, right? You know, they probably got a you know, bulk deal for deal for buying in bulk from one place. Or whatever the case is, but you know, your environments can become much more resilient the more diverse they are. You're not susceptible to these sort of failures that can take down your entire system. So they're after this, they're talking about moving some of this work away from Christmas and Easter, which is another time that they like to do real work. So their real priority is getting commuters in and out of London. That's essentially all they care about. I mean, what they've told all these passengers, so these are people that may only take these long distance trains to visit family once a year. They're not gonna take these trains again, right? Next year, they're gonna buy a plane ticket. So they've lost those customers effectively for life. Now, commuters, it's a much bigger business. You know, they're maybe more critical. They kind of hate you anyway if you've ever taken the trains. So they can sort of, you know, what people are saying is they can sort of work around delays a little bit better. And they're kind of a captive market, right? Like, if your train is canceled and you can't get to work one day, you're still going to take it the next day. You're not going to go out and buy a car and say, forget it, I'm never taking the train again. That's kind of how you get to work. So they're looking at shifting some of this work, you know, out of it. And I think that's something that we can learn from, right? Is understand your traffic patterns. Don't just get that one, you know, the old RRD graph showing your in and out traffic and just pick a low point. Understand, like, are there, you know, do we have different patterns? Get a graph that shows, you know, the dollars going through your website at different, you know, times a day. It may not match up with your traffic. Are there times a year that it's better to do some of these things? You know, the outage at the station was actually much worse because on a holiday like this, a lot of the passengers were kids. They had a lot of old people. Everyone had bags. You know, on a typical Monday morning, it's just business travelers with, you know, backpacks and suitcases and stuff. So they're easier to shift to another station if you have to than families traveling, you know, with a lot of luggage that aren't familiar with the train system to begin with because they don't take it that often. And it's also, you know, just something about, you know, do you really do these outages at what you think are your quietest times, or do you start doing them, you know, during busier times? You always, you know, you hear about these things where people, in big distributed systems, I'm going to try turning off in a whole data center and see what happens. Do you do that at a quiet time, or do you do that at a busy time? If you do it at a quiet time, what happens if the data center doesn't come back on? Or, you know, some critical system there fails during the outage? Well, you've got a few hours left until the curve starts turning, and now you're doing it at a busy time. So maybe you should start just planning on doing these things during a busy time and kind of prepare for the worst. Communication is the first thing to go when this happens. I think everyone's seen this sort of head down debugging, you know, during an outage. Everyone's so focused on the problems at hand. You know, someone's trying to fix the hydraulic system. Someone's trying to shuffle the train drivers back and forth. No one really was kind of looking at the big picture and put their hand up and said this. And so keeping lines of communication open during an outage is really, really critical. This one talks about the drivers and their shifts and how that hadn't been taken into account. I think this is really, really important. This never happens in IT because you would just have another train with Red Bull and pizza coming in to keep the SRE is going until the outage is done. But you really have to plan. Plan on a 10-hour day. Say, we're going to do an outage, and it can only last 10 hours, maybe with a 2-hour contingency so people can work for 12. But all too often, you end up with people, you know, sleeping under their desks, you know, that kind of thing, trying to get an outage sort of gone bad. But we're building infrastructure now, right? So why does a train driver have legal protections about how long he can work? Because if he works longer than that, it's unsafe. But the people building sort of critical internet infrastructure can just go on this Red Bull-fueled, you know, thing. So, and there was one more about just, you know, that's their thing. That's it. Thanks. I'm about out of time. So find me if you have questions.